with the mask on, but it is good to be back with you again. We'll have more to say in the next hour. We have limited time this morning, so I want us to get right into what we're going to be talking about this week. If you take out your Bibles and turn to the book of Hebrews, that's where we're going to be this morning. In fact, that's where we're going to be most of the time this week. I want us to focus on the book of Hebrews, with the exception of this evening, which sermon will be live stream. It won't be from the book of Hebrews, but the rest of them will be, Lord willing. The task for this week is to stay in keeping with your theme about getting to know Jesus, knowing Jesus better. And what a wonderful thing that is, because He is our Lord. We want to be like Him, and to be like Him, we must come to know Him. Not just know about Him, that's where it starts, but to know Him is what we're going to be doing. And so we're going to try to do that from the book of Hebrews mainly. Now, in our daily walk with the Lord, often our task to be a Christian becomes a wearisome one. We get worn down. We become discouraged from time to time. And it's the role of every Christian, and I think especially preachers of the gospel and as well as elders, to try to revitalize one another. In fact, that's one of the reasons for our assembly here together today. That's the reason why we have singings. That's the reason why we have Bible studies and we are in one another's homes. That is the reason why we have this gospel meeting even. It is an ongoing process. But thankfully, to help us to this end, the Holy Spirit also saw fit to give us a book on the subject of revitalizing tired Christians. And that's the book that we're going to be studying throughout this week, the book of Hebrews. The need to be revitalized, to be revived, I think is nothing that is new. It has been a problem since the very beginning of Christianity. And the original recipients of the book of Hebrews in the first century shared many of the same basic problems that we go through today. It seems that the Hebrew Christians that he's writing to here wanted to call it quits. At least some of them did. And there are probably several reasons why that is the case. And I want to look at some of those just for a moment as we get started this morning. Maybe it was that Christianity had become nothing more than just a routine. You know how it is when you start out on something and you get to do that for a while, it becomes routine. For a young person starting out driving, they have to think about how to stop soon and they have to think about where they're going. And yet us who are seasoned in driving, we just get in the car, we don't even think about putting our right foot on the accelerator and then turning it over to the brake when we want to stop. It's just something that we do. Well, you can do something over and over and over, and eventually you get to doing it without even thinking about it. And we live the Christian life year after year so that it becomes so familiar. Unfortunately for some of us, it just becomes old hat. It becomes nothing more than just a routine that we have developed. And we can find ourselves just going through the motions without reflecting on the meaning of Christianity. That may have been the case in the first century as well. Or maybe there were some Christians who had made their initial commitment to Christ under the moment of excitement, and they were simply caught up in this prevailing mood. You know, there were lots of people who became Christians on the day of Pentecost and the days that followed that, and there was this sense of excitement that was going on in Jerusalem, and they're in each other's homes, and they're meeting in the temple, and maybe they expected those peak experiences to basically be this daily affair, but they weren't prepared to return back to normal again, normal everyday life. You know, I've seen this happen, especially with young people. Maybe they go off to camp and they have some great spiritual experience and everybody's spiritual and everybody's talking about things and they're singing always and they're praying. They come back home and it's just not that way. And they go back to school and there's the problems at home and maybe that feelings of excitement aren't there anymore. There's a tendency to get discouraged after you come down from that high point. Or maybe the Hebrew readers were converted in a time where they expected that the Lord would return at any moment. That seems to be the implication, as I understand it, in chapter 10. That they were expecting the Lord to come back, and they had kept this high level of commitment for a while, but they couldn't maintain that enthusiasm year after year. And I imagine that was a big problem in the first century, not knowing that it would be at least 2,000 years until the Lord came back. They're thinking the Lord may come back any time. And every day that goes by, they're thinking, well, He's not back yet. And maybe they get more and more discouraged each day. Or maybe these were second generation Christians now who had grown up in the church, as we say. And what I mean by a second generation is a Christian who is someone who was raised in what we call a Christian home rather than becoming a Christian in their adulthood. So often the doctrines of faith are passed down to the next generation, but the fire and the enthusiasm is not. And maybe that was the case there. Or maybe the Hebrew readers felt that the worship services of the church seemed very plain and ordinary when they compared it with what they had come from. I mean, they were used to being in this elaborate temple with these priests and gold everywhere and these sacrifices. And now they're just meeting in homes. And it's kind of boring, really, when you think about it compared to what they had come from. That it lost maybe some of that excitement that they were used to. Or, most of all, maybe their Jewish friends and families were putting some pressure upon them to give up Christianity. Again, chapter 10 seems to imply that they had some persecution. But whatever the specific reasons were, the readers found themselves, as it says in chapter 2 and verse 1, drifting away from what they had heard. And we're going to talk about that more in the later this morning. And so the author of Hebrews had this difficult time of encouraging these Christians and calling them back to faithfulness and renewal. Now, I realize that at first glance, the book of Hebrews may not look like a book about church renewal and revival. The book is filled with all kinds of complicated arguments. In fact, in many respects, I believe that the book of Hebrews may be one of the most difficult books in the New Testament to understand. Because it consists of a bunch of different arguments comparing Jesus with various aspects of the Old Testament in order to show that Jesus is better. That he is superior to everything and everyone in the Old Testament. That Jesus is greater than the prophets. And Jesus is superior to the angels. That he is a better lawgiver than Moses. He is a better rest provider than Joshua was. He is a better high priest than any of the Levites, especially Aaron. And he is a better sacrifice as he gave his life on the cross than any of the Old Testament sacrifices were in the Old Testament. And those are some of the things we're going to be talking about over the next 4 days. But the book of Hebrews is not just this long extended argument. There's something different about the book of Hebrews. For one thing, we're not told who it is written to. Traditionally, we've understood the book of Hebrews to be written to Jews, and thus the name Hebrews. And that makes sense because of its content. But what Hebrews? One's in Jerusalem, the one dispersed abroad, we don't know. And not only do we not know who it was written to, but we don't even know who it was written by, because it doesn't say that. If you read this letter in English, which is what we do here in America, you then would assume that it is written by Paul, because so many of the thoughts that are expressed the way that Paul would express them. In fact, are the ways that Paul did express them in other letters. But if you read it in the Greek, you almost, with the same amount of certainty, would think that it's not written by Paul, because he uses completely different language, far different from the type of vocabulary and grammar that he would use in the books that we know are written by him. So there's some people who think that that's not written by Paul. And some actually suggest that maybe Paul wrote it, but he wrote it in Hebrew to the Jews there in Jerusalem, and then it was translated into Greek and dispersed abroad, and we have the Greek version of that. We just don't know. There have been other guesses. Some people have said Apollos. Some people say Barnabas. Some say Aquila, maybe even Peter. The fact is, we just don't know. And it probably then comes to a surprise to find out, since we don't know who wrote it and who we wrote it to, that we don't know when it was written either, but most likely written before the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, according to, again, Hebrews chapter 10. If it was written by Paul, we know, of course, it had to be written before he died. Most people write letters before they died, not afterwards, so it would have to be before AD 64. But for all that we don't know about the book of Hebrews, there is something that we do know. And that is that the central message of the book of Hebrews is that Jesus Christ is the answer to every human need. There is no book in the New Testament that focuses in on Christ, on Jesus, better than the book of Hebrews. And if we want to get to know Jesus, we have to get to know the book of Hebrews. It's the most systematic presentation of the greatness of Jesus Christ in the whole Bible. And so this morning, I just want to spend a little time with us looking at the first chapter of the book of Hebrews. From the very get-go, the Hebrew writer makes the argument that Jesus is greater, and he sets the stage for the rest of the book. So he begins with this argument, and that is that Jesus is greater than the prophets. Here's the opening words of the book of Hebrews. In verse 1, God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. You know, when God spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, it was thunder and lightning and dark clouds, and it was just a great thing. But then 700 years on that same mountain later, he spoke to Elijah in a small, still voice. He spoke to Job in a whirlwind. He spoke to Daniel and Joseph through visions, Ezekiel through dreams and things of that nature. In other words, he did, as it says there in verse 1, that he spoke through the prophets in many different ways. And the revelation of God through the Old Testament prophets was given bit by bit. From the very beginning, Genesis 3, we find out why Jesus is coming. We find out later in chapter 12 that it would be through the seed of Abraham. Later on in chapter 50 that it would be through the tribe of Judah. We get to 2 Samuel chapter 7, we find it's through David. We go to the book of Micah and we find out where the Messiah would be born. The book of Daniel tells us when he would come on the scene. The book of Isaiah tells us what his nature would be, that he would be a rejected Messiah, not a greatly splendid king like they were expecting. And so we see that here is the Messiah who's being presented to us bit by bit. So it is true that God spoke at many times in many different ways through different people. But now, here's what verse 2 makes clear to us. In these latter days, in the days that we are in now, God has spoken to us through his Son, the Word, as John 1 tells us, that became flesh and dwelt among us. There's no one else quite like him. Like Jesus. There were some great men and great women in the Old Testament. There were some great prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and others who were great. But Jesus is more than just a messenger. He is the Son of God who made the world, as verse 3 says. He is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature. That is of God's nature. And he upholds all things through the word of his power. When he had made purification of sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Notice that there. Not only is Jesus creator, but he is the exact representation of God. There's a story told of a man named Peter who went to the school at the University of Minnesota. And one of his friends was an art student, and the teacher, professor gave the art students a project to paint a portrait. So he asked Peter if he could paint his portrait. And Peter agreed, and the art student started painting his portrait, turned it in to the professor. And when he got his grade back, he saw that he received a D- on that project. And the art student went to his teacher and asked him, why do I have such a poor grade? And the teacher said to him that his proportions were all wrong. He said, his head is too big, your nose is too long, your ears are too distorted, one eye was not level with the other, the shoulders were too wide, and the feet were humongous. Well, the next day the art student came into the professor's office and he brought Peter along with him. And the teacher took one look at him and said, okay, you have an A+. Because Peter was actually, this was an exact representation of Peter after all. It was a portrait. It was an A+ portrait. It turns out the picture did look like Peter. And the Hebrew writer says, you want a perfect picture of what God looks like? You want an A+ portrait? Then look at Jesus. He is the portrait of God. And the term that he uses here is that he is the exact representation of God. And the Greek word that's used here is the word charakter, which, by the way, we get our English word character from. And behind this word lies the idea of an engraving, the process of stamping soft or hot metal and with a pattern which the metal will then continue to bear. You see, the ancient world, obviously, they didn't have printing presses, but what they did have is something like what we would use to make coins. And the Roman emperor would have his image stamped upon a coin, where the engraver would go in and get an exact representation of his picture and then put it on different coins and disperse them throughout the Roman Empire. And that's what the Hebrew writer says about Jesus, is that this Jesus is the perfect imprint of the Father. When you look at Jesus, it's like looking at that coin and you see the exact representation of Caesar. You look at Jesus, you see the exact representation of God the Father. Now suppose there was an emperor who had waited a long time and he wanted to tell his whole kingdom, his whole empire, what he looks like. And so what he did is he sends messengers throughout his empire and he gives a verbal description of what he looks like. No doubt he'd say, I'm handsome and I've got a perfect nose and that type of thing. And he writes it on and he sends it out, giving them detailed descriptions of himself through these messengers. But then along comes this imprinting process that's finally invented. And there is an artist who comes along and he makes the exact representation. He puts it on coins and he now distributes it throughout the empire. That's what the Hebrew writer is saying here. That for a long time, God sent out these descriptions of himself in many portions and in many ways by these messengers, by his people, the prophets. But now he's given us his exact image, Jesus. People sometimes say, you know, if God could just come down and he could show himself to us, he could reveal himself in some way, then we would obey him, then we would know him, we would embrace him. But the thing was, is there was a person who showed us what God looks like. And it's as if God took a perfect snapshot of himself and sent it down to earth. And that photo is Jesus Christ. He is the radiance of his glory, the exact representation of his nature. And with this opening statement in the book of Hebrews, the Hebrew writer sees all of biblical history coming to a climax in Jesus. And time again, the Hebrew writer will start an argument by reading from the book of, or the Old Testament, and then shows how it points forward to something better, something greater. And time again, that something or that someone that it is pointing to is Jesus. God's own Son, the one who dealt with our sins fully and finally, the one who now rules at the right hand of God, the one through whom everyone is to submit, even the angels. So right from the very start, the Hebrew writer has fixed his eyes on Jesus. And by the time we come to the end of the letter, he brings the letter to a close and he again will urge us in chapter 12, keep your eyes fixed upon Jesus. Jesus is greater. And so he starts out saying Jesus is greater than the prophets. But the rest of chapter 1, what he's going to make the argument of is that Jesus is greater than the angels. I want you to look here, beginning in verse 4. He says this, having become as much better than angels, he's inherited a more excellent name than they. There is a fascination, isn't there, in our society, in our culture with angels, in reading books about angels, collecting angels. Especially around the end of the year, you see angels everywhere. You see angels in these movies doing special things from the tabloids and the magazines and the movies, television. There's a lot of attention that's given to the topic of angels. And I certainly think that angels are a relevant topic for us to study and for us to talk about. But my concern is that most people, when they think about angels, they don't think about angels from a biblical perspective. And there's a serious problem if we're getting our understanding about angels from a movie or a television or the National Enquirer about what angels are supposed to be. You know, doing a little research for this lesson, I came across a book on the internet that was entitled The Everything Guide to Angels. And if you'll notice, if you can even see it up there, the subtitle says, Discover the Wisdom and the Healing Power of the Angelic Kingdom. The summary of the book online says this, according to angel expert, I didn't know there were angel experts, but evidently there are, Karen, I guess that's Paolino, I'm not sure. Angels are everywhere, and they're just waiting for a chance. They're just waiting to help people. With this guide, you will learn to communicate with the angelic realm for guidance, healing, and protection from harm. Thousands of angels can be called upon to help solace, watch over children, and create a prosperous life. goes on to say that in this guide you will learn how to develop intuition, open your mind to angelic communication, use meditation to connect with angels, gain protection, healing, and forgiveness from angels, perform an angel card reading. I'm not sure what that is, but I guess it's something like a tarot card. Karen Paolino, who was trained by the world-famous angel expert. So not only do you have angel experts, but you have world-famous ones. Never heard of her. But Doreen Virtue, which is a great name if you're going to be studying about angels, traces the history of angels in various cultures and regions. She identifies the hierarchy of angels and their individual roles as messengers and protectors, and shares stories of her communications with angels and provides real-life examples of angel miracles. With her help, you will have the confidence to call upon angels for love, support, and guidance. And the book goes on to tell you all kinds of things that angels can do for you. For example, if you have something broke around your house that needs fixing, maybe a computer, a car, you're supposed to call upon Michael, the archangel, because that's his expertise. And if you're lost somewhere, you don't need your GPS, you call Michael, the archangel. There are angels that are experts in finding things. You've lost your keys in the couch or something like that. You call on an angel to help you do that. There are shopping angels that will help you find the best price on something. If you're wondering what gift to get somebody, an angel there can help you find the perfect gift. There are weather angels. You have a big event coming up, a wedding or some outside thing, a vacation. You just talk to that angel and they'll give you the perfect weather. There are parking angels who will help you find the best parking spot in the parking lot. And even according to this book, there are angels that drop coins from heaven, so that if you find one on the ground, basically it's a message from the angels telling you that everything is going to be okay. I don't know what your reaction to all that is. I think I can guess. But I'm totally amazed. Amazed that, first of all, not only that someone would write a book like this, but there are actually people who are buying books like this. And they take it seriously. But we shouldn't be surprised, because what really people are seeking is God. And they don't even know that. But they don't want the one true God. They want gods. And they call them angels. One man who wrote about the TV show Touched by an Angel said the reason that people have become so infatuated with angels is because angels ask nothing of us. They simply want to help us. In other words, we don't have to do anything. We get unconditional help from them without anything wanting from us. It's like a genie in the bottle. And it's not a God who's going to hold us to any type of accountability. The ancient world, they wanted gods, but we are too sophisticated to call them gods. We call them angels. And so what's the truth about angels? Do we all have guardian angels? I mean, we could go into a great depth of study. Actually, the Bible doesn't say a whole lot about angels. A lot of things that people believe about angels obviously are wrong as you look at the scriptures. We know very little about it. So my intention this morning is not to talk about angels as much this morning. But what I am going to say this morning is that anyone who's consumed with the fascination of angels, they are consumed only with what is second best. You see, that's because the Hebrew writer makes it clear that Jesus Christ is far superior to angels in any way. And to make this point, he spends the rest of this chapter talking about that. And he doesn't just quote one Old Testament passage and leave it at that. That's all it would take. But he uses no less than 7 Old Testament references to talk about this very subject. And the reason that he's so emphatic on this point is because there were a lot of people in that day, both in the church and in society, who worshipped angels. Paul refers to this, I believe, in Colossians chapter 2 and verse 18, where he says, "Let no one defraud you of your prize through the worship of angels." They were evidently incorporating that into Christianity. And you see, this fascination with angels that we see in our society is nothing new. John MacArthur, in his commentary on the book of Hebrews, talks about this very thing. And I'll put that quote in front of you. You can read it if you like, but I won't take the time to read that. But they were fascinated with angels, much like the people in the book that I just pointed out to you are even today. What's the difference between an ancient Jew believing these types of things and a woman who's selling her book and making millions of dollars off of Amazon? There's really not much difference at all. So what that means is what the Hebrew writer is saying in chapter 1 back 2,000 years ago is also necessary for us today. And what the Hebrew writer does is he gives us 5 reasons why Jesus is superior to angels. Let's look at those. Number one, Jesus is superior. He's greater than angels because he has a better name. Verse 4 again. Having become much better than the angels, he has inherited a more excellent name than they. What name does Jesus have? Well, for which of the angels did he ever said, "You are my son. Today I have begotten you." And again, "I will be a father to him and he shall be a son to me." Here he is quoting from Psalm 2 and he says, look, Jesus is referred to as a son. What angel did he ever call his son? The answer is no, none, none of them. Jesus is the Son of God. The angels, as we're going to see, were just servants. And does it make sense to hold the servants of a family in higher esteem than you would the Son himself? Jesus is greater because he's a son. Angels are just servants. Second of all, Jesus is worthy of our worship. Notice verse 6. And when he came again, when he again brings the firstborn, that is Jesus, into the world, he says, "And let all the angels of God worship him." Jesus was never commanded to worship angels, but the angels here are commanded to worship Jesus. And if they're to worship him, then obviously Jesus must be greater than them. People have always been tempted to worship angels throughout history. Even John the Apostle in the book of Revelation, he sees the one, he's caught up in all of these things, and he falls down and worships at the feet of the angel, but the angel says to him, "Don't do that. I am a fellow servant of yours and of your brethren and the prophets." What the angel says, don't do that. And I think the message for us, by the way, in the book of Revelation is no one is worthy of our worship except for Jesus, not even angels. Jesus is superior because he is worthy of worship. Angels are not. Jesus is, thirdly, greater than angels because he's the creator, not the created. Angels, he says, who makes his angels winds and ministers a flame of fire. Notice the key word here is that he makes them. He created the angels. But in verse 8, he says of the Son, he says, "Your throne, O God, is forever and ever, and the righteous scepter is the scepter of his kingdom." You see, the difference there is that angels were made. He makes the angels, and yet Jesus is the creator. Jesus wasn't made. He is forever. And that is the statement of John in the book of John, chapter 1, in the first three verses, that he in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and he was in the beginning with God. And all things came into being through him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has not come into being. Jesus is creator. But then fourthly, we understand that Jesus is greater than angels because he is eternal. Quoting from Psalm 102, he says, "And you, Lord, in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the works of your hands. They will perish." Notice that. They're going to all perish. All the works, all creation, including the angels. "They will all become like an old garment, and like a mantle, you will roll them up like a garment. They also will be changed, but you are the same, and your years will not come to an end." The angels didn't create the earth. They are a part of creation. But Jesus is the creator. And one day he will do away with the old creation. He will bring in a new creation. And just as everything in creation had been from the beginning, so the end will come. But Jesus Christ will never change. And later on in the book, he will say, "Jesus is the same, yes, today, yesterday, today, and forever." He is eternal. He always has been, and he always will be. That's superior to the angels, because they were created. Then the fifth and final argument that he makes is that Jesus is king, in verses 13 through 14. Notice he says here, "But to which of the angels has he ever said, 'Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for my feet'?" No angel has ever been promised a place at God's right hand, but Jesus has been. And thus, he tells us in verse 14, as he sums up this chapter, here's what angels are. They're ministering spirits, sent out to render service for the sake of those who will inherit eternal salvation. He's not diminishing them. They have an important role, a very important role, but not as important as the Son. The destiny of Jesus Christ is that ultimately everything, every knee will bow to Jesus, even the angels. What we're trying to do this morning is try to get to know Jesus. And so we find that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, is superior to angels in every way. He is Lord and God. He creates, He sustains, He governs, He redeems, He cleanses us from all sin. He is the one to be worshipped by angels and by all other creatures in the universe. He is omniscient, He is omnipotent, He is unchanging, He is eternal, He is superior than all. Jesus is greater. And let me tell you why I think this is so important. And that is because it is inherent within us to try to find something or someone to worship, someone bigger than us, to emulate, to adore. And we see this happen all the time as people fall over themselves and they drool all over themselves over the latest athlete or the latest actor or the latest musician. I want to tell you, in this election year, it's the latest politician people are falling over. And they have given their allegiance to either Biden or to Trump rather than God. Jesus is greater than any politician. And we've got to remember that as Christians as well. Our allegiance is not to the flag only. Our allegiance is foremost to Jesus Christ. The problem is that we have to be very careful to whom we give our adoration. No person can save us. No public figure can forgive us. No angel can transform our hearts. Jesus alone is eternally God, the one who has made us, who can save us, who can forgive us and transform our hearts and minds. The Hebrew writer wants to make sure that we don't make the mistake of putting the creature rather above the Creator. The Hebrew writer will begin chapter 2, and we'll look at this in the later hour, in just a few minutes, by saying this: for this reason, since Jesus is greater than prophets and angels, we have to pay much more closer attention to what we have heard so that we don't drift away from it. For if the words spoken through angels, that is the Old Testament, proved unalterable and every transgression and disobedience received a just penalty, how shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? Look at what was given through the angels, the Old Testament. And if you're punished by not obeying the words of the angels, and now Jesus has given us His word and He is greater than angels, how much greater punishment will we receive if we neglect Him? Don't fall away from Him. Don't drift away from Him. And brethren, I'm not so much scared of any of you in this building this morning bowing down to an angel. I don't think any of you are worshiping Gabriel or Michael or anything like that. But what I am afraid of is that you, that I, bow down to other gods. Whether it be my work, your work, whether it be your kids' recreation, your education, your recreation at home, your movies, your television, whatever it is that you give so much effort, so much time to, whatever you spend your money on, indications of what your angel is, what your God is that you're bowing down to. And what the Hebrew writer wants us to understand is that Jesus is far superior to any of those. He is greater. He created all those things. And if you are just settling for those, you're settling for second best. I know our time is gone, but let me give you one illustration before we leave. All of you who are parents who have little children can relate to this. At Christmas time, we will get a present, maybe a $50 present that's big, and get it before our 2-year-old or 3-year-old. And we've wrapped it up in beautiful paper and bows on top. And it just shows how special the present is inside. And they go in, they unwrap it, and they open up the box, they put the toy aside, and they play with the box. And you're sitting there thinking, why did I just spend $50 on a box, right? I could have just given it a box and they would have been just as happy. Well, you know what? They've neglected the present for the wrapping. Jesus sent all these prophets and angels, and that's His wrapping. And some of the first century Christians were taking the box and playing with it rather than the gift. And we do the exact same thing today when we put anything above God. Let's not just play with the wrapping, the box, but let's focus on the gift, Jesus, because He is greater. Appreciate your attention this morning.